Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
Open the pod bay doors now.
I'm sorry, Dan. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the most you ever lost in the contest?
Go ahead. Make my day.
Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Black Hole Cinema. A new voice for you in the hosting chair this week. My name's Dan Taylor, and also a new guest on the show as well. Joining us all the way from High Wycombe, we have Leslie Byron Pitt. Hello, Leslie.
Hey, how you doing? You all right?
Yeah, not too bad. Am I right in thinking we can find you on Twitter at Afrofilm Reviewer? Is that right?
It's Afrofilm Reviewer, yes, indeed. Yeah, that's where I usually just bitch and moan about about films, politics, and life. And it's also the name of my blog as well. So, yeah, you can find me there.
Lovely. And as always, the man in the chair, the voice from the black hole, Mr. Tony Black.
Hello. Isn't he good, Dan? Isn't he a good host? And I must say this. I've just found out the most random coincidence in terms of Leslie. Because I know Leslie through Letterboxd, which, you know, most of you listening are probably listening from Letterboxd. And I love the fact that Leslie knows me through being recommended by one of my best friends who lives in the same city as. It's just, I had no idea about this. So, Adam Massingham, if you're listening, you cheeky monkey, you're a legend.
I think we were watching the Real Madrid game last, when they were in the Champions League last year, and that's how I got invited by my mate Ollie, and that's how I met him.
Brilliant. Brilliant. It really is a small world. So that's a nice little tidbit. But yes, hello everybody.
So we've got the usual reviews coming up for you and the box office top 10. Tony, what films have we got in store this week?
We have four films today. We've got Ex Machina, which is Alex Garland's directorial debut, which we'll all be talking about. Then we have Whiplash, which is Damien Chazelle's second feature, which is taking everyone by storm. Following that, I'm going to utterly, mercilessly destroy Mordecai, because it's crap. Anyway, I'll get to that later.
You didn't even leave it to, like, any, you know, didn't leave it to any suggestion. Just, yeah, it's going to be horrendous beatdown.
I'm just it's crap. It's mainly because we're going to review it later in the podcast, and I want you to keep listening. Okay, so that's why I've dropped that in now. And then finally, Leslie is going to talk about A Most Violent Year, which myself and Dan haven't seen to our utter shame yet.
So we'll get started straight away with Ex Machina.
So how does a programmer get to be meeting the CEO?
I won a competition.
The president can't get Mr. Garrick on the phone. You got the golden ticket.
It's good to meet you, Nathan.
It's good to meet you too, Caleb. Can we just get past the whole employer-employee thing?
Cheers. In many ways, this building isn't a house. It's a research facility. I want to talk to you about the greatest scientific event in the history of man.
Are you building an AI?
Hello.
Hi.
I've never met anyone new before. Have you?
None like you.
Tony mentioned, Ex Machina is Alex Garland's directorial debut. He's known for writing Never Let Me Go, Dread back in 2012, and earlier on, 28 Days Later as well, which is way, way back in 2002. I kind of remember that one. Yesterday.
I always think it's important just to remember that him as a novelist, because all his protagonists are very similar. They're all mid-20s, quite naive, never sure what they're going to get into type guys. But yeah,
and that perfectly describes Caleb, played by Domhnall Gleeson, who's a 24-year-old coder at the world's largest internet company. He wins this competition to spend the week at the private mountain retreat of belonging to the reclusive CEO Nathan, played by Oscar Isaac. And also it's about basically his work working on AIs, the world's first true artificial intelligence, named Ava, who is played by Alicia Vikander, who I believe is also in another film which was released last week, Testament of Youth. So Tony, tell us about that one.
I went into it with fairly high expectations because I do like Alex Garland as a writer, even though I wasn't a massive fan of Dread. And to truth be told, I wasn't a massive fan of Never Let Me Go either, but I liked what they did. So I was quite curious to see this, and I was very interested by the setup. So I went to see it on the day it came out with my girlfriend, who was also very, very keen to see it. Yeah, and we got in there, and it was not, I suppose, quite what I expected. I'm not sure I knew what I was expecting. I knew it was going to be quite introspective and careful and quiet, and that's the film you get. It very much just focuses really on this relationship between these two men and where the AI, Ava, comes in between them, and quite really what Nathan, who's Oscar Isaac's character, is trying to prove with this. And it's one of those films that really is very much about ideas as much as it is about character and about story. There isn't really that much story, to be honest. I mean, there's about like 10 characters in the whole thing. Well, 10 actors, only of which about 4 characters are really, you know, important to the story. So it's a very, very, very claustrophobic film. Very set in one specific place, you know, this vast base that Nathan works out of and he's built. And it really does feel a lot of the time like you're watching something that is, it's almost like a philosophical debate on screen, really, that's being played out with characterization. And it sounds like I'm knocking it, and I'm not, because I thought it was a very, very good film, but it was missing something for me. And even now I still
Is it a twist?
I don't know if it's a twist.
All the way through, I thought he's going to be an AI. That's what it is. He's the AI all the way through. Well, that's going to be it. And they went for the twist, and then it never happened. And I was like, oh, maybe I don't.
See, strangely enough, I was thinking the exact same thing. I won't lie.
I thought it's going to be really predictable. And actually, I'm kind of glad it wasn't that predictable. But at the same time, I feel like it missed something like that, like a twist or something that you weren't expecting. Even though, obviously, that, as I said, was something I was expecting. I think it was just kind of missing that, and it kind of went down the road I thought it would otherwise.
One thing I actually really enjoyed about the movie, the setup is so, so quick. He wins this contest, and it's told visually, as opposed to congratulations, you've won a contest, and loads of strenuous characters doing nothing for no reason. I didn't find anything to be missing from it so much. I think it kept me on edge more than enough. I'm just recently read a really, really interesting article from Badass Digest from a Film Hulk, whoever that pseudonym is, and he talks about Nightfall, and he talks about the idea of not necessarily having films all to be on this sort of character arc, and you know, not everyone learns lessons at the same time, and not everyone has to learn a lesson in a film, or you know, or it bends on certain arcs, and we don't all have to follow the writer's journey. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why I really, really enjoyed this. And I think what I liked is it's this kind of modern day Frankenstein story. I didn't particularly need a twist so much. I feel that, you know, even cliches can be done, as long as they're done well, can be entertaining, and I really liked how it was slow burn. I do like what you said, Tony, about the fact that they're kind of engaging in all these kind of sort of philosophy and technology talks and all these little things, and you're wondering what is this about? What are you building to? What are you getting to? And when it gets to the end, I actually really enjoyed it because it's a little bit like Black Mirror. It's a little bit dark.
That's exactly what I thought.
And it goes a little bit dark, and you know, it's the answer's kind of in the name as well, Ex Machina, you know, Ex Machine, and it gets a little bit scary, and I think that's kind of what I like about it, because it does get into that sort of horrible space of, well, if it has a conscience, if it thinks like us, what will a machine do? And that's something that I've really engaged with.
I do agree. I do agree with a lot of what you're saying. It was very good. I think when I say it's missing something, I think the point is this is possibly the whole point, actually, that it didn't really necessarily make me feel a great deal. It was very intelligent and it made me think, but I don't know if it really got to me. It was creepy. It was edgy, and it was saying a hell of a lot. But I think I appreciated what it was talking about and what the script was getting at than actually the emotional impact of the whole thing. And that may well be, like I say, the point. I think that a lot of what Garland's doing really is, he talks about actually in interviews about how this whole film was formed of a years long debate with a friend about whether or not, you know, artificial intelligence could be determined, and if it does mean, you know, consciousness exists and all these kind of things, and that's why there's quite a lot of good, like, hard as it can get anyway, science behind a lot of this. You know, one of the big things in the plot is the Turing test, which is the very central thing of it, and there are other thought experiments in there, and this whole film really felt like one big thought experiment in many ways, and I'm fascinated by all that, and the film, it gets into a lot of that. It really does get into a lot of that. And you don't often see that in films. A lot of films don't have the bravery to just take their time and to really get into all that discourse. And I really, really like that. And I like the way Garland, you know, Nathan has gone a bit mad. He has gone a bit isolationist. He's started to believe that he's a god in what he's creating. And that's why I quite like the fact that, you know, Garland surrounds him by nature, because there's this one scene where Oscar Isaac is standing on top of this waterfall that's cascading behind him, talking about his creation. And, you know, it's this whole idea that, it, you know, there's always this constant reminder of there is a greater force at work here, mate. You know, what you're trying to do isn't necessarily going to work. And obviously the whole morality tale of it is in this whole, like, chess game that seems to be happening between Nathan and Caleb, there's another player. And that's what ultimately we get to at the end. And it's very cleverly done. You know, it kind of touches on the whole thing of how Garland's also saying, he's also said that he's interested in the idea of AI not necessarily being malevolent and actually, you know, being a positive development. But I just don't know. I just feel like it just didn't connect with me in the way that it should have done. And that quite possibly it's the kind of film that will reward a second viewing and will get to me then.
I can see where you're coming from, and I think one of the reasons why is that third player, the extra player that we're talking about, is a machine.
Mm.
And a lot of how we feel about this, you know, stems from the fact that if we do believe she's a robot, we may not believe she has that sort of conscience or anything. We might not have any feeling to her. I think it's all about that performance and how she, you know, puts us makes us feel and puts us in that uncomfortable space of how am I feeling about her? You know, we're supposed to see it through Gleason's eyes. And I really got that. I think one of the things I really like is her performance. It is interesting. Mm. It is good. Mm. And it does sway from robotic to very, very caring and sensual. And I think one of the things I really like is, I didn't have such a, like, visceral reaction, but a lot of the people in the audience did at certain points in time, especially near the end. And I think one of the reasons why is that I think they completely fell into it and they fell in love with it. And I think Garland does succeed there. I do think I need to watch it again.
It will reward more viewings, I think. It is a film that potentially could be better, actually, when you watch it second time round, and you can really, you know, digest it properly and not... Now, like I said, I wasn't expecting a twist as much as more perhaps an emotional payoff, but I think it is very good. And it's the kind of film that, like I say, a lot of filmmakers wouldn't have the balls to really do without throwing in an action sequence or throwing in a massive twist or throwing in, you know, oh, AI is evil. You know, it's a lot more complicated than that, which is to its credit, really.
Ex Machina is in cinemas at least for the next couple of weeks, but I imagine it will draw on into February as well. Up next, we've got a review of Whiplash.
This place is nice.
I really like the music that they play. Bob Ellis on the drums. I'm part of Schaefer's top jazz orchestra. It's the best music school in the country.
The key is to just relax. Don't worry about the numbers. Don't worry about what the other guys are thinking. You're here for a reason. Have fun. 5, 6, and.
I want to be great.
And you're not.
We got Buddy Rich here. Little trouble there. You're rushing. Here we go. 5, 6, and. Were you rushing or were you dragging?
I don't know.
If you deliberately sabotage my band, I will gut you like a pig.
Oh, my dear God. Are you one of those single-tier people?
You are a worthless pansy ass who is now weeping and slobbering all over my drum set like a 9-year-old girl.
Whiplash, it tells the story of a 19-year-old guy. His name's Andrew. He's played by Miles Teller. And he is first year in Schaefer Music School. Really wanted to succeed, really wanted to do well. And he finds himself at the hands of his, what could only consider as a monster of a teacher named Terence Fletcher. He's this hideous ball of just rage and continuous, you know, of error checking and just a horrific person. And there isn't too much more to the story than that, more than it's just kind of more just a battle of wills between this young guy who really wants to succeed and this, like I said again, monks standing in his way to try and trip him up at every corner. And you know, there doesn't seem to be any reason for why Fletcher is so horrific, but we do find out a little bit more about him, a little bit more about his methods and why those methods are about. It is just a really, really interesting film, which isn't really so much about jazz, but more about methods and teaching and whether that is a good or a bad thing, or whether it's good to learn out of fear, or whether it is better to maybe learn out of, you know, bleeding liberal methods.
Yeah,
it is. I found it to be quite a tremendous film. I think it's I think it's a really good film. I think Damien Chazelle has this really, really interesting textured film. It's one of these things where there's not too much going on in it, as such, in terms of narrative. You're not going there for a really complex plot, but in terms of how he sets up the plot, how he sets up the characters, how he sets up these relationships, how he sets up the relationships with the drums, how he sets up the relationship with Andrew and maybe his first date, there's just a lot of texture and rhythm going on in it throughout. And of course there's what we can only say is the performance of the month, near the year, J.K. Simmons plays this horrible, horrible person who is just attacking at every, you know, it's one of those things where if you were born of a certain age, you could probably find a teacher like him. He's amazing in this film.
He is.
I think he's a really, really strong, powerful force of nature throughout, and it builds and it builds and it builds and it builds, and this just tension is more like a psychological thriller than it is than it is any film about jazz. Once again, I really enjoyed it. It's been a good month for movies for me. So
it's January's been a fantastic month, really, because we're getting some of the overspill from the end of 2014 in America, you know, and they're in all the Oscar build-up kind of films. And I'd heard of Whiplash a couple of months ago, and I didn't know much about it. And when I heard it was Miles Teller, I was like, oh, because I've seen Miles Teller in a few things, like the awful 21 and Over, where he played an absolute bell end for the whole film, and I was just like, oh God, he just come across as a very smug kind of guy, and I was You know, and that's why I was very uncertain when he was cast as Mr. Fantastic in Fantastic Four, which is coming up later in the year. But I went into this, obviously hearing increasing buzz, you know, I was getting more and more excited because I was looking on, you know, Letterboxd and seeing reviews, and there wasn't anything under exhilarating, you know, and it's rare you get. I mean, in fact, I was looking on the top 100 Letterboxd films of all time, and Whiplash, by virtue of the scores it's got over the last few months, is now in the top 100 of all time, simply by virtue of its rating, which is remarkable. It is a fabulous movie. There's no two ways about that. For a second feature by somebody, I mean, it's remarkable actually that Damien Chazelle has managed to create something this good. In fact, he's in danger of peaking really, because I don't know how he's going to get to this level again. You know, he wrote this out of frustration that he couldn't get other projects off the ground, and based on his own experiences being in a band when he was younger. And then it got a lot. He had to film a short version of the film with J.K. Simmons as Fletcher and another guy playing Andrew to get funding to do the whole thing, because they weren't convinced that a film about a jazz teacher psychologically destroying his, you know, student would be good cinema. But how wrong were they?
I mean, that's ridiculous. You know, it wouldn't be good cinema. I mean, which producer comes up with that nonsense, considering that we've seen films such as, like, Tape, you know, which is all situated in one room with three people, well, and it still manages to have a certain sense of space and form. I mean, this has space and form by the bucket loads. I mean, one of the things I really like about it is it's edited to just perfectly.
Mm.
Just the way the drums hit, as I was saying, that it's a really textured movie, and one of the things that Chazelle does really well is insert shots and close-ups.
Mm.
I'm a big fan of small moments in films, small moments when they build up to big moments, and one of the things I really enjoyed was when Andrew goes on his first date, and he goes on this date with this girl, and it's a really lovely little first date and everything else like that. And there's a really, really small moment just at the end where her foot just touches his, and it doesn't say too much, it doesn't say too little. It's just a lovely little part. But there's also the other things that we see. You know, the drumming gets so hard, so you're seeing battered and bruised hands just getting sunk into ice water. You're seeing, you know, these horrible plasters just being wrapped around and all this bleeding. You're seeing the sweat and literally sweat and blood bouncing off cymbals at times, and it's just this. You can see how it's been made cinematic. It's been cinematic in that way. I think when people think of cinema and things being cinematic, they think of the vistas of Ford, like, you know, big grand vistas, and that's the only thing, and widescreen and whatnot. But no, I think he makes it very intimate, and he's really, really good at that. I think one of the things I liked about this film is all about relationships throughout the relationship, because Paul Reiser is in it as well as Andrew's dad, and there's a relationship there, and that's going under a certain amount of pressure as well. You know, there's questions of masculinity and questions of ego more than anything else. It's interesting to see how this character moves along throughout the film and becomes more like his teacher.
It's about that psychological obsession and this desperate need to please, and that's one of the things that drives the film. I think the reason that, yeah, as we talked about earlier, the reason it struggled to get traction at the beginning was because, you know, music films, you know, jazz isn't necessarily the most popular subject in the world. Miles Teller's not a big name. J.K. Simmons is a character actor. He joked in an interview recently that he's that guy from that film. You know, until now, he's very much been that guy. You know, most people probably know him as J. Jonah Jameson from the Spider-Man films, but he's been waiting for this. This is his role. This is the role that he's going to be remembered for, without question, because he's remarable in this. I mean, it is a tremendous performance, because he's just completely visceral, you know, and he's a monster. He's a monster, however, with this kind of drive, and this is, as you say, this is what Andrew tries to become in a way, in order to prove more to himself, I think, than Fletcher. But Fletcher's whole methodology is that the method is more important than the person. And the method in this case is pushing someone to the absolute limit. You know, the film often goes back and talks about how Charlie Parker was made, effectively, the great jazz musician, Charlie Bird Parker. And there's this slightly apocryphal story, which apparently isn't true, that Charlie Parker became Charlie Parker when a cymbal was thrown at his head and almost decapitated him by his mentor. And he uses that example as the whole idea that the more you push somebody, the more you absolutely push them to breaking point, the more genius they're going to create. And he says this great line where he says, the two most destructive words in the English language are good job, because it just allows people to coast. And that's the whole idea of the film. He's pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. And he's been absolutely horrendous to these people. You know, he's just psychologically destroying them. He's calling them faggots. He's saying their parents are useless. He's saying that they're... It's terrible, you know. And the film admittedly does... in the end, have his methods questioned by authority, because you couldn't get away with this as a teacher in a normal school, you know. And if you did stop, the whole film rushes at you like at a million, you know, at warp speed. And if you stop and analyse it, there are, you know, you would have to sort of go, it hold together? But it does, because it's just a rush. It is an absolute adrenaline rush.
The one weakness of the movie, of course, is when his methods are really questioned.
Yes.
Really under. And there's also... There's two moments in the film. One is quite a tremendous set piece. So you turn around and go, would anyone pull out of that? But the other thing is, of course, when the methods are questioned and the reason why those methods are questioned. And then by the end of it, it's all kind of shrugged off a little bit. And it's all a little bit like, well, hang on a minute, something... kind of happened here, and you know, tears of one person aren't really going to cut it, considering. But on the flip side of it, by the time you really start thinking about that, you're already caught up in the film's ending, and it's something else. It's this fantastic combination of mentor and student in complete sync.
Yeah,
and it's really, really something. And I think one of the things I like about it is it's not very political. It's not very, you know, I do like the big heavy films, but there's nothing like that in here. It's very lean, it's very, you know, clear cut and very straight and to the point, and amazingly focused throughout. And I think that's one of the reasons why I really enjoy it. It's just, it turns around and goes, here's an adult film, and you know, it's going to be as enjoyable as, you know, all these summer films, and it's going to do it really well.
Yeah. Quicker. It's a thrilling film. It is a thrilling film. It does a lot of what, you know, big action blockbusters can only dream of in terms of hooking you in, engaging you in, keeping you excited at what's going to happen next. You know, engaging you with the characters. You feel like you're with him all the way through. When Fletch is shouting at him, you can feel it. I mean, there's four words that he repeatedly says that are absolutely terrifying, which is not quite my tempo. Not quite my tempo. When he's banging the drums, and there's this amazing scene where he makes them drum the same beat for just a fraction of a second, again and again and again, and it goes on for 5 hours, and he breaks him down, and he's like, no, again, and he does this hand movement where he just stops, you know, he flicks his hand up like after like about three, flicks his hand up and goes, nope, again, 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 and it's just. You're just sitting there, and by the time, like you say, the climax comes, the ending, it is just... I left the cinema, and I immediately found the soundtrack on Spotify, and I just danced my way home, basically, because it leaves you on such a high that you're buzzing from it. Apart from maybe getting a little bit too much into Fletcher's psychology, which I thought brought it down, and the fact that if you do stop and analyse it, it wouldn't necessarily all make... complete sense. It is a fantastic film, and it does deserve to be up there vying for Oscars. It won't win Best Picture, but I think it deserves to be nominated.
So we said last week that actually we'd quite like Edward Norton to win, because obviously he's alongside J.K. Simmons in Best Supporting Actor. But obviously, from what you've kind of been saying, this is kind of Simmons' performance of his career.
I've changed my mind, Dan, now.
Yeah.
It's Simmons.
Would it be a misjustice if
it's,
just win it?
Yeah, it's Simmons for me now. Great as Edward Norton was, if Simmons doesn't win this, it is genuinely a massive injustice, because you may not see a better performance this year. And if that performance doesn't go down in cinematic history, then I'll be surprised, because it really is one of those wow.
Well, that sounds like that's probably going to be the one to watch this week. We'll be looking at the UK box office from last weekend. We've got four new releases this week. The first two are going in at number 10 and number 9. Testament of Youth at number 10, having taken just over half a million in its first week. We've then got Wild in number 9, which obviously is starring Oscar nominee Reese Witherspoon. At number 8, we reviewed it a few weeks ago, Birdman. That's now there 3 weeks, and probably will slip out of the top 10, I'd imagine, next week, unless it gets a little bit more buzz around it and people go and see it for that very reason. Number 7, we've just reviewed it, new release Whiplash. That took just under £1 million in its first week.
Should be higher. and it may.
It's not bad though.
It's not bad.
English box office.
It may get more. It may get more traction. It's possible, but then it's not really.
It surprised me that it's taken more than Wild. To be fair, that would have been the one that would have taken more out of those two. At number 6, still hanging around in its sixth week. It's Hobbit. That's for the Five Armies. That's now taken $61 million to date, which is an astronomical amount of money. If only they would hand me that to make a film. That'd be nice, wouldn't it? Number 5, it's not moved at all. Paddington, still taking money, took over $1 million this weekend, or last weekend, shall we say, alone. Number 4, we absolutely ripped it apart last week. It's Into the Woods.
Boo!
Second week. People are still going to see Meryl Streep, because there's not a lot else to see.
Yeah.
Number 3, it's held its place quite well, and I'm glad it has, because it's absolutely brilliant. I've just watched it myself. The Theory of Everything.
Hey!
That one's taken nearly $20 million, and it's in there, as I said, hanging in at number 3 for the third week. And the final new release of the week, American Sniper, which took nearly $4 million in the UK. I'm sorry, I didn't actually put it into pounds before I did this. pretty impressive for a first week in this country.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Particularly for an Oscar-nominated film. When I saw it, it wasn't that busy, but then I guess down here in Devon, we don't seem to come to the cinema.
Yeah, it was...
People in the bigger cities, but...
It was quite busy in Birmingham when we saw it. No, Wolverhampton, actually. It was quite busy in Wolverhampton. It was... Yeah, it's done very well in America as well, from what I know.
Yes.
It's absolutely romped home. It's been like very
$200 million domestic in America.
Which is a lot for this kind of film. I think a lot of it's Bradley Cooper. You've got a lot of, you know, women who are going to, and this sounds awfully sexist, but there's probably a bit of truth in it. There's a lot of women who are going to go and want to see a buff Bradley Cooper, quite honestly, to see this film.
I thought he was looking a bit chunky, actually.
Yeah, well, he is. He's not really ripped and toned. I read a very good article this week, actually, about how he put that 40 pounds on. A really good article in something like Men's Health about how he didn't want to become ripped, because Chris Carl wasn't ripped. He was just like a bear. He was just a man mountain, and that's what Cooper becomes, you know. So really quite dedicated. He put a lot into becoming that big. So I think
his performance is really good.
It is a good performance, and I think he's, you know, it's not a bad film at all. It's not amazing, and it's made more money than it probably deserved to be, and I'm not very keen on the politics of it, but yeah, it's a bit I'm not surprised it's done well in America, because it's saying things that Americans want to hear.
I'm surprised it's took so much in this country as well, because it is very much an American film, American sniper, so for that reason I'm surprised.
Yes, but going back to what Tony said about sort of the politics, there is a for me perfectly, when I watched the film, I felt there was a very conservative look on it. I think it was very right-leaning. I think the final 10 minutes are a little bit hawkish, to say the least.
Mm.
But it is one of those things that only seems to come into it depending on who you are. You know, it's one of those things where I think Eastwood at times does try and get it on the balance of the balance of the knife, and you can lean either way. But I think the nature of Kyle as a person himself kind of dominates, and you know, from what it sounds like, he wasn't the nicest person. I think the most important aspect of that movie, no matter what anyone says, for me, is the fact that after all he does, his own demise, unfortunately, because I don't wish death on anyone, his own demise is not seen. It's faded out. It's left and almost mythologized. He becomes a myth. He becomes, quote unquote, the legend. And I don't think there is any sort of, I don't think there's any sort of sarcastic take or sort of side look at that. I think, you know, because one of the most important aspects of it is the fact that it was a veteran that killed him. And I think that's the most important thing. I think that's a really important thing to know. Whatever your politics are, whether right or left, I don't believe films are apolitical at all.
Quite often not.
Unfortunately, it really doesn't come as a surprise, I guess, that Taken 3 has held down its place at the top of the UK box office, despite being knocked off in America in its second week. It's matched up and hold down, nearly taking $5 million last weekend in the UK, which... Yeah, it's such a shame. Come on, Britain.
The only thing it's doing is taking us for a fool now. That's all it's doing.
Sorry, it just angry.
Just needs to go away. Leslie, you just go back a couple of podcasts and listen to my rant on it, because it's just rubbish. It needs to go away. I wouldn't say this to Liam Neeson's face, obviously, because he'd hit me, but it just needs to go away now.
Like, I wish someone would come up.
Yes.
Quite frankly, I never want to see an Taken.
I made the promise to myself last year that when it comes to certain franchises, certain blockbuster movies, and certain aspects, I'm not in. I stopped with. I used to turn around and go, well, okay, well, this is Twilight, and I'm going to go into it to see. This is obviously the reaction it's getting, so I need to see what the reaction's about. But unfortunately, I sat down and I'm like, this isn't a good movie.
This is a good book.
It seems my New Year's resolution is to see these things so you guys don't have to, quite honestly.
Very true.
That is the unwritten podcast rule.
Yeah.
Yeah. Watched on so many people.
Which moves us nicely on to Mordecai.
3 months ago, a Spanish museum sent a Goya painting to be cleaned. Painting has disappeared. This very bad man who wanted to fund violent worldwide revolution. Countless lives are at stake.
And you would like me to find it?
Precisely. What is in it for me, as they say?
Do it for Queen and country.
No. All right, Queen and country, travel and living expenses, reasonable overhead.
Done.
I am Lord Charlie Mordecai. Respected by all who know me slightly.
Excellent shot, sir!
Man down! I am an art dealer, an aficionado. My wife, Joanna, my only true love.
I thought I'd see how you secret agent men run the world.
I'm afraid I shall have to put my foot down, darling.
Sorry.
With your permission, of course.
Oh, God.
Mordecai is directed by David Kopp. So obviously famously starring Johnny Depp as the title character alongside Gwyneth Paltrow, Ewan McGregor, and thank God he's in it, Paul Bettany. The storyline basically is juggling some angry Russians, the British MI5, his impossibly legging wife and an international terrorist, art dealer and part-time rogue Charlie Mordecai must traverse the globe armed only with his good looks and special charm in a race to recover a stolen painting rumoured to contain the code to a lost bank account filled with Nazi gold.
Now,
go ahead, Terry.
Well, now, doesn't that sound good? I think that sounds really good, that. I do. I think that sounds like a great film. It sounds like a bloody blast. Then you watch it. Oh, God. Okay, well, it seems like every week now there's a film that I go and see that is just the wrong choice. You know, I don't pick A Most Violent Year. I don't pick The Gambler. I don't, you know. I go and see Mordecai, which is because I like Johnny Depp for my sins. Even though he seems to be systematically trying to destroy his own career, I like him. You know, I do like him. Right, yes, okay. Even when he's spending, you know, hours and hours mugging at us in the Pirates films, or when he's making stuff with Tim Burton that isn't as good as 25 years ago, I still like him. I still don't mind watching him. But he's pushing his luck now. He's really pushing his luck. Like Liam Neeson's pushing his luck with doing the Taken thing. Johnny Depp is pushing his luck by coming on and going, and within 10 seconds, he's going, "My name's Charlie Mordecai. I am an English gentleman. I will do this voice all the way through. Darling! Ooh, rather, with that kind of weird American sort of tint to my accent all the way through. Darling! Ooh, I say." How irritating was that?
You could see from the poster that he's just going, "Here he is, darling."
That's it. That what I just did, which is irritating for a minute, for 100 minutes, that's what you get, okay? From the off, "My name's Charlie Mordecai."
You can no longer walk like a normal person, talk like a normal person, and act do facial expressions like a normal person.
He's
character choice.
Yes, he is. It's a parody of himself. He's given up acting, Johnny Depp. He's just playing pantomime now, and he does that for that long, and you immediately think it's weird. Sometimes there are certain films where you just immediately know it's not going to be very good, and I really felt that with Mordecai very early on. It's just so miscalculated. It's trying to be kind of like a 50s, 60s kind of caper film, a bit like an Ealing kind of comedy in a way. As somebody described it as, and I thought this at the time, Depp is playing him like Terry Thomas mixed with the 13th Duke of Wyndham from The Fast Show, right? Which has been said, Mark Kermode said that, and even though I was thinking of Rowley Burke in QC, the guy in the Fast Show who's in the chair going, "Cheese!" Blah, 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 blah.
Oh, yeah.
Right, but it's actually the 13th... I'm the 13th Duke of Wyndham, and ooh, girls. It's a bit like Leslie Phillips-esque. Mm. He's that combined. He looks like, but then he looks like David Niven, you know, or in something. And it's that kind of, it's kind of an anachronistic kind of thing, because it's the kind of thing you would have seen 50 years ago in old English gentry, but it's been brought forward to the modern day. So, you know, Mordecai's this lord of the manor. He's got a manservant who's a gruff cockney who goes, "Yes, sir. Cool, sir. I'll do that for you, sir." Imagine Parker from Thunderbirds, but, like, much more attractive and younger and who can kick ass. That's basically Paul Bettany in this film, right? And then you've got his stately posh wife, Gwyneth Paltrow, who's basically a sex pot, who just, you know, saunters around getting repulsed by his moustache. And I've never known a film so obsessed with someone's moustache. The whole film, a lot of the film is about how his moustache brings out a gag reflex. I'm not making this up, right? And it's just like, just stop focusing on his moustache. You know, it's ridiculous. And then, she's miscast, you know, because she's just not very good. She's just not suited to play an English lady because she's not English, you know. It's just not that necessarily matters, but it does in the context.
This is someone that was it Emma? She was Emma, and she did pull that off very well.
Well, that was written by Jane Austen. This was written not the screenplay, but this was written on the back of a napkin, I think, on a flight. It's just actually that's not fair, because it's actually based on a book called "Don't Point That Thing at Me," but by Kirill Bonfiglioli, I think his name is. And I was actually browsing through it in Waterstones today, and it's basically a novella. You know, it's like something like 120 pages long. It's a very, very short book, and I don't know the tone of that, but I flicked through. It seems to be a very similar kind of thing, you know, and it's a caper. You know, it's meant to be jolly. It's meant to be funny. It's meant to be, I say, ooh, rather a bit cheeky. A bit fun, you know, in that there's car chases, there's fights, there's action sequences, there's guns going off, there's this little sneaky plot about not saying Nazi gold, there's a little bit of winks to terrorism in there, there's, you know, Hugh McGregor, who's basically like the Lestrade to Mordecai's crap homes, you know, and he's like this dogged inspector who's thick as two short planks, besotted by Gwyneth Paltrow's calculating lady, who's also trying to come to things with their own angle. You know, there's billionaires, there's nymphomaniacs, there's, you know, there's all these different people floating around, and you put all that together and it should be a blast. It should be a lot of fun. It should be making you laugh. The only bit in the film that made me laugh, because it is a graveyard of comedy, you know, I've never seen so many gags fall flat in my life. The only thing that made me laugh is when at one point Mordecai checks into an American hotel which is full of hipsters, and there's girls, you know, parading around in, like, you know, underwear and bikinis, and he goes, "Oh, we appear to have walked on the set of a porno," you know, and it's just like that. And then he goes to the desk and he says, he's just trying to get the attention of the concierge, and he goes, "Would you like some help with your bags?" And he goes, "No, I've got a fucking manservant," you know. That made me laugh, just because it was just that was fun. That was one of the only things that made me laugh. And Paul Bettany, who is, he's better than this, really. I mean, he's playing a character called Jock, who's just such a... He's basically a manservant who he's just kicks ass, basically sleeps with every woman in his path, but he does it with a bit of charm and grace, and he's the only likeable person in it. And even though you can tell Bettany knows, I think, that this is crap, it's one of those films where everyone's having a good time except you. You know, when you watch it, they're all loving it. They're all having a whale of a time filming this. You know, you can tell, right? Johnny Depp's walking around going, "Ooh, darling," like this. It's just like, I'm sitting there going, why don't I leave? Why am I watching this? Why am I still here? I can't describe it. It's not terrible. It's not offensive. It's not like the worst thing I've ever seen. It's fairly decently put together. You know, David Cope tries to inject it with some fun and everything, but it just doesn't work. It's just really, 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 really unfunny and irritating. And Johnny Depp,
it's as if he's made, you know, he's trying to make these serious films occasionally, but they're all this is. But, like, you know, he's done The Rum Diary a few years ago, and I think The Tourist was trying to be good. And it's almost like,
sorry,
They're so trying to be good. Nobody likes them, so it's just gone, fuck it. Why do I bother trying to make a decent film? So I'm just going to make shit from now on.
I think that's what he's doing. He needs... He's in that period that Steve Martin was in, when Steve Martin was in, like, the mid... Well, you could be honest, you'd argue he's still in it, really. The mid-90s to the noughties, when he's making things like Cheaper by the Dozen 2 and Bringing Down the House and... You know, Sergeant Bilko and all this, and he's making absolute shit after shit after shit, and everyone's going, do you remember when he made The Jerk? Remember when he made The Man with Two Brains? What happened to this guy? And you're now at the point where you're going with Johnny Depp. Do you remember when he made Edward Scissorhands? Do you remember when he made Ed Wood, Donnie Brasco? All these films. Do you remember that, Johnny Depp? And now it's like, what? Where did he go? Because he should now be maturing into. You know, he's at last, he's starting to look his age. At last, he's starting to get a bit lined and middle-aged. And I like that, because he could naturally sort of grow into this, you know, quite talented middle-aged performer. But he needs a Bowfinger. I thought Bowfinger was the one where Steve Martin reminded me why he was great and why he was funny. I love Bowfinger. I thought it was very good. Johnny Depp needs something like that now. He needs a really well-written, genuinely funny part that suits him perfectly, where he just doesn't mug at the camera for an hour and a half. You know, I mean, the worst thing he can do is make another Pirates film, which is exactly what he's going to do.
Because what I think he needs to do is, I think he can keep making his crap, but just do it under the name of Jack Sparrow. Because he's basically playing is that character.
I don't know what you're talking about. I thought, you know, he was just bored in Transcendence.
So were we.
Yeah. We bloody well were.
Quite a lot of the Johnny Depp ones on paper sound like they could be quite good.
Yes.
They're just not.
Exactly. And Mordecai's exactly that. Mordecai, when you read that synopsis out earlier, that's a good film. That is a good film in the making. And they've royally, royally fucked it up. And it is genuinely such a misfire of proportions that, you know, it's hard. You can't really grasp until you watch it. It's not a terrible, terrible film. It isn't. Basically, what I'm saying is, I'm one of these people who, if you tell me something is grade Z awful, Troll 2 levels of bad, The Room, I will lap it up, right? We're not talking that. We're talking about something that's just rubbish, and it isn't even worth seeing rubbish. That's the point. And if anything, those films are worse.
So if there's one film not to go watch this week, it's Mordecai.
Oh, hell
yes. You might want to go and watch. You might want to go watch A Most Violent Year.
I understand you and your men have a job to do here, but we're in the middle of a 10-year-old's birthday party.
I'm sorry, but we are coming in.
That's not a problem. We have nothing to hide from you. My husband is a good man. Don't mistake his honesty for weakness. He deserves respect. This was very disrespectful.
I run a fair and clean business, and I will fight till my last breath to prove that.
These are dangerous times, and we have to adapt. It's not like when we was driving.
There were more murders and rapes in this city last year than there have ever been. So if you've come to tell me that we have an urgent security issue here, trust me, I'm aware.
This can't continue. You're at war here.
It's been 2 years since you started investigating my industry. Do you have any idea who's been doing this to us?
Or you may be doing something to bring this on yourself.
I have always taken the path that is most right. The result is never in question for me. Just what path do you take to get there?
A Most Violent Year is directed by J.C. Chandor, who did the fantastic All Is Lost last year, as well as Margin Call a few years ago. A Most Violent Year is a crime drama set in New York City during the winter of 1981, statistically one of the most violent years in the city's history, and centered on the lives of the immigrant and his family trying to expand their business and capitalize on opportunities as the rampant violence, decay, and corruption of the day drag them in and threaten to destroy all they have built.
Sounds a barrel of laughs.
Yeah. Is it a barrel of laughs?
Not at all. It's a really, really, I found it a really, really engrossing slow burn thriller. One of the things I really enjoyed about it is it comes off like it sounds like it would be a gangster movie, but it's not. But there's elements of, you know, elements of the gangster genre in there. one of the things I really, you know, the trailer sets itself up to be, it sets itself up in a certain way, and it sets certain characters in a certain way, and then when you watch the film, watch it play out, you realise how dangerous other characters can be in terms of the stakes. And one of the things I really enjoy about it is it's dated back to 1981. The stakes are quite high in what's going on, and the idea of one immigrant trying to be a legitimate businessman in the 80s in New York, and just the constant pressure he's finding from the law, the constant pressure he's finding from his own family and his wife, and the constant pressure he's finding from everyone else who's playing dirty while he's doing his best not to play dirty. Now, it's for me today, I mean, I watched it earlier this morning, and today is kind of like the Oscar Isaac day for me. I don't know what it is, it's just him in that and Ex Machina. And he's really good in this. If Ex Machina is him going a little bit crazy, this is him trying to just on constant repressing and pushing down all his baser urges. This is him trying to fight with the fact that his masculinity is being put into doubt because he's not wanting to engage in violence when everyone else around him is. It's this wonderful, wonderful film which kind of is juxtaposed with all this kind of warm cinematography, apart from obviously when it's there's some snow in certain scenes, but there's this really golden tinge to a lot of the cinematography. It looks almost like it should be set in the 70s. It's got a kind of James Gray thing going, but it's generally just this really hard, slow-boiled movie where, you know, he's playing off really well off David Aiello, who's also having a good year with Selma, and Jessica Chastain, who is brilliant in this. She's got this really vampy look to her, and, you know, I won't say too much, but the more you find out about her, the more intriguing the film gets and the more worrisome everything gets because of everything that's going on. It's one of the films where the money that is at stake and the livelihoods that are at stake doesn't seem like it's that much because it's quite self-contained, and most of the bigger films in nowadays are all about saving the world. But there's something so engrossing to see how the tension is just ratcheted, like in every scene, and it just builds up slow and it builds up slow. It's almost like the remains of the day of crime dramas, and just the idea of holding everything in and keeping everything so repressed and still, and just allowing everything just to simmer. It's really, I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the cinematography of it. I really enjoyed the look of it. It's this film that uses space really well. You have characters situated by all this negative space, so it's, you know, everything looks a little bit incomplete, or they're covered in shadow when everything's just a little bit shady. And I'm looking back at it now as I'm talking about it, and I realise there's moments where people are shot in complete shadow and darkness, and when the revelation comes later, you look back at when they were shot in this darkness, and you're like, that's very interesting. It's smart like that, and it's just generally a really absorbing piece. It's going to kind of lose out in January. I think it's going to struggle with everything else vying for awards and vying for everything when this kind of small film kind of pops out. It's, you know, really well directed, really nicely put together. It hasn't got, you know, the dialogue isn't really, really sharp in terms of, you know, it's not punchy dialogue, but, you know, the screenplay really works. It's got this fantastic notion that nobody is going to get away from this clean, and everyone has to get their hands dirty. Yeah, it's just that kind of movie. It's, you know, if you're into something like Killing Them Softly, or like James Gray's We Are the Night, We Own the Night, I think you'll get a lot out of it, because it's not an out-and-out loud I'm a gangster movie. It's a sort of quiet crime drama where, you know, you just doubt everyone's intentions and reasons behind everything. And even now, I'm looking back, and the final moments of the film just has just a little speech by David Aiello, just a little conversation, and the conversation is interesting. Just the way it goes in there. Like I said earlier, nothing is apolitical, and just what is said at that moment and what transpires before then as well. It's very, very interesting, and it's really, really illuminating. And it's one of those films where if you've seen the poster, it's a shot, it's a bullet hole, and black liquid is coming out of it. And once you find out why that poster and why that moment is taken, once again, it goes into the whole idea of it being, you know, quite political, and you know, it's got a little bit of intrigue in there. But it's also really timely as well. I mean, it deals with how we deal with aggression, should we deal with aggression, with more aggression, should we have an eye for an eye. It deals with everything that American Sniper says it's dealing with but doesn't. It's just generally really absorbing piece. I really enjoyed it.
You said obviously that it's a shame it's going to get lost in January, but actually that's something that Chandor has actually done within the last few years. You know, again, All Is Lost, which was released about the same time in 2013, it was released December, January, so again, it got lost then. Did get nominated, I think, for something like, you know, Sound or something, but it didn't actually get any major award buzz, and it got lost. And I remember the screening I went to of All Is Lost, and I was the only person watching it. And Margin Call, very much the same, again, was released in January. It's not one I saw for a few years, I think, but it was one of my favourite films of that year. And it's almost like he doesn't want anyone to see his films, which is obviously a strange thing to say. It's almost like he's quite happy, you know, if it doesn't win an award or it doesn't get nominated for anything, then actually that is almost a better film for it. Something that people will hopefully, you know, see and watch in, you know, a few years' time. And then that's how it will get its, you know, its recognition, is through people watching it through DVD sales and stuff like that, even though obviously we're moving to Blu-rays now. And it does seem like he's very, you know, I've not seen this one yet, but I saw all the, you know, his other films so far, and it's all about the performances. It's all about the characters and, you know, performances that the actors give. And Chastain particularly has been applauded for this film by critics, and you know, it says that she gives one of probably her strongest performance, you know, of her career. And this is from someone that was in, you know, Zero Dark Thirty and
Tree of Life.
Tree of Life, that's the one. You know, in someone that's already given, you know, some fantastic performances, and there are people that are saying that so far this is the performance of her career. And I guess it is a shame that people aren't going to see it in the cinema.
I really like Chastain in it, and it's also one of those things where I like Chastain in it not because I kind of fancy her, not to be completely rude and sexist there, but it's one of those things where she is this sort of stunning woman, and you know, she shows time and time again how good she is an actress every time. Like, and here I'm not entirely sure if it's her best performance, but it is one that also shows that she's really, you know, she's really capable of getting hold of these complex women and, you know, doing really good work with them.
Great. So would you say that's your favourite film of the week? Or would you go with something?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's interesting because at the start of the month, I went to London to watch Whiplash, and I was like, that's amazing. It's so exhilarating. It's brilliant. It's, you know, kind of, oh wow. And then I came today and I'm really in two minds between Ex Machina and A Most Violent Year, just in terms of they bring some really interesting things to the table. They both have really, really strong female performances that of course will kind of get lost. I think with A Most Violent Year, that's the one I can't wait to kind of rewatch as a double bill with Killing Them Softly, just to see how they play with, you know, their settings and stuff like that. I mean, I'm a big advocate of Killing Them Softly. I think it's short, sharp, and I think it's it hits really hard, especially that those last moments with Brad Pitt. And I think it's the same here. Well, you know, I think they both films really do well with how the economy dictates everything.
that these people do. And that's the really scary, you know, it's statistically the most, you know, it's called the most violent year, and it's statistically one of the most violent years. And, you know, if any, you know, if when people do their history, everyone knows that in the 80s they had a terrible time in New York in terms of crime. And, you know, now it's less, and there's a lot of what people are saying is gentrification and everything else like that, and people are moving along, and money's being spread around everywhere, and you see less of that. And I think that's the most interesting thing, that you have a film that's looking back at it and going, yeah, well, this is kind of what was kind of going on here, even though it's not really, you know, it's a kind of piece of historical fiction there. And I think there's so much to unpack in those 2 hours. I think that's the one currently that I'll be looking at again and again and again. But I know what I'm like. I say that, and at the end of the year, it'll be, you know, 10 different movies that I really like. So, you know, that's just me.
So that's three very strong films this week, and one not so strong film that we won't mention.
That's putting it mildly.
So we've got three definitely to go see there. Me and Tony will be back next week. You can find us all on Twitter. I'm at Dan Thomas Taylor. Tony is at Black Hole Writer, and Leslie's at Afro Film Viewer. You can also find the Black Hole on Facebook. There's a page, Black Hole Cinema, if you want to go give us a like. Until then, we'll see you next week. It's bye from me, and bye from Leslie.
Goodbye.
And bye from Tony Black.
See you soon. Oh, in fact, no, I'll do that as Mordecai. See you soon.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.